Her brother had repeated to her the rumour that during that period he had won prize money in excess of £10,000. Yet somehow she had never thought of him as a rich man. Then, with sudden intuition, Robin realised that by that gesture, Clinton had laid down a silent challenge. And with a little smile, Mungo St. John had accepted it. Robin felt a flare of alarm. She was certain that Clinton Codrington had chosen an opponent too experienced and skilled. She remembered that Zuger, who relied on gambling to eke out his regimental pay, had been no match for the man, even with moderate stakes, and in his frustration Clinton had been drinking steadily during the evening. She was sure his judgment would be faulty, even if he had any knowledge of the game. Almost immediately, St. John subtly altered the style of his play, doubling the stakes before the draw, crowding the game, dominating it, playing from the strength and confidence of his already considerable winnings. And Clinton seemed immediately uncertain of himself, hesitant in accepting the doubled stakes, discarding rather than going at risk for more than a few guineas, lacking the nerve to meet St. John head-on. Robin moved slightly to a position from which she could watch both men. Clinton was pale under the deep water tan, the rims of his nostril bloodless, and his lips compressed into a thin line. And she remembered that he had drunk a dozen glasses of champagne during the evening. He was nervous, indecisive, every watcher could sense it, and their disappointment was evident. They had hoped for a dramatic confrontation when Clinton had made the flamboyant gesture of placing £100 on the table. But when the amount was slowly whittled away by unexciting, overcautious play, their interest was transferred to a lively exchange between Mungo St. John and one of the Clutie sons, the family that owned half the Constantia Valley with its fabled vineyards. They laughed at the light banter with which the two men made their bets and admired the grace of the loser and the easy manner of the winner. The other players at the table were almost forgotten, picking up an uncontested ante, or falling before the aggression of the leading pair. Robin could only pity Clinton, nervous and pale, when he fumbled his cards to expose prematurely one of his few winning hands and suffer the chuckles of the spectators as he picked up odd guineas instead of the 50 that might have been his if he had played it correctly. Robin tried to catch his eye, to make him leave before he was further humiliated, but Clinton played on doggedly, refusing to look up at her. Clutie won a hand with four of a kind, and as was his right, called for a pot to celebrate his good fortune. "Three of a kind to open the pot and guinea sweeteners," he announced and grinned across the table at St. John. "To your liking, sir?" "Very much so," St. John smiled back, and the other players tried to cover their discomfiture. It was a dangerous game, requiring one of the players to be dealt an initial three of a kind to commence the game, but for every unsuccessful deal, each player had to contribute a guinea to the pot, and when a lucky player achieved the minimum requirement, he could advance the stakes by as much again as was in the centre of the table. It could amount swiftly to a huge sum, and there was no option of withdrawal. A very dangerous game. 10 times the deal failed to produce an opening hand. And then, with the pot at 70 guineas, Mungo St. John announced quietly, "She is open, gentlemen, as wide open as my mother-in-law's mouth." Play had stopped at the other tables in the room as St. John went on. "It will cost you another 70 iron men to stay in the game." He had doubled the pot, and the watchers applauded the bet and then looked eagerly to the other players. "I am your man," said Clutie. But at last there was a breathlessness to his voice. He counted out the notes and gold coins and spilled them into the considerable pile in the centre. 3 other players withdrew, dropping their cards with alacrity, clearly relieved to have got out of danger for a mere 10 guineas. But Clinton Codrington hunched miserably over his cards, and St. John had to prod him gently for his decision. "Please don't hurry, Captain. We have all evening." And Clinton looked up at him and nodded jerkily, not trusting his voice, then pushed a sheaf of notes into the centre of the table. Three players, St. John said, and swiftly counted the money in the pot. 210 guineas. The next bid could double that amount, and the one after could redouble it. The room was silent now. The players at the other tables in the room had left their seats to watch as the dealer gave two cards to Mungo St. John to replace those he tossed into the centre of the table. He was buying honestly, trying to add to the triplets with which he had opened the pot, neither faking a flush nor a full house. Clootie bought three cards, evidently looking for a third to a high pair. And then it was Clinton's turn to request cards. One, he mumbled, and held up a single finger. The finger quivered slightly. The dealer slid the card across to him, and he covered it with his hand, unable to bring himself to look at it yet. It was all too obvious that he was attempting to find the missing card to a flush or straight. The opener to bet, said the dealer, Mr. St. John. There was a pause as St. John fanned open his cards, and then he said, evenly, without a change of expression, the bet is doubled. 420 guineas, said somebody loudly, and this time nobody applauded, but every eye swiveled to Clootie as he consulted his cards, then shook his head abruptly and let them drop. He had not found another king to go with the original pair. Now everybody looked to the remaining player. A transformation had come over Clinton Codrington. It was hard to define exactly. There was just a touch of colour under the tanned cheeks. His lips were slightly parted, and for the first time he was looking directly at St. John. But somehow confidence and a barely suppressed eagerness shone from him. There was no mistaking it. The man positively glowed. Double again, he said loudly. 840 guineas. He could hardly contain himself, and every man in the room knew he had found the card he needed to transform his hand from worthlessness to a certain winner. St. John did not have to deliberate more than a few seconds. Congratulations, he smiled. You found what you were looking for. I must concede this one to you. He dropped his cards and pushed them away from him. May we see the cards you required to open the pot? Clinton asked diffidently. I beg your pardon? St. John's tone was lightly ironical, and he flipped his hand face upwards. There were 3 sevens and 2 odd cards. Thank you, said Clinton. His manner had changed again. The trembling eagerness, the nervous indecision, both had disappeared. He was calm, almost icy, as he began to gather in the piles of scattered gold and banknotes. What cards did he have? Demanded one of the women petulantly. He does not have to show them, her partner explained. He beat the others without a showdown. Oh, I'd die to see them, she squeaked. Clinton paused in gathering his winnings and looked up at her. I beg of you, madam, not to do so, Clinton smiled. I would not wish to have your life on my conscience. He turned his cards face upwards on the green baize, and it took the company many seconds to realize what they were looking at. There were cards of every suit, and not one of them matched another. There were delighted exclamations, for the hand was utterly worthless. It could have been beaten by a single pair of sevens, to say nothing of the triple sevens which St. John had discarded. With this valueless hand, the young naval captain had beaten the American, outsmarting him for almost 900 guineas. It was a spectacular coup. The company gradually realized how carefully it had been engineered, how Clinton had lured his adversary, how he had made a pretense at fumbling uncertainly until exactly the right moment, the moment when he had struck boldly and decisively. They burst into spontaneous applause, the ladies ooing with admiration and the men calling congratulation. Oh, jolly good play, sir. St. John held the smile, but his lips drew tighter with the effort, and there was a savage glitter in his eyes as he stared at the cards and realized how he had been duped. The applause subsided. Some of the spectators were beginning to turn away, still discussing the hand, and St. John began gathering the cards to shuffle when Clinton Codrington spoke. His voice was low but clear, so that nobody about the tables could miss a word of it. "Even a blackbirder's luck can run out at last," he said. "I must admit, I would rather have caught you at your dirty slaver's game than beaten you out of a few guineas tonight." The company froze, gaping at Clinton with expressions of horror and comical amazement. The silence in the room seemed impenetrable. The only sound was the ripple and click of the cards as Mungo St. John began to shuffle them, splitting the pack with a click and then running them into each other under his thumbs in a blur of movement. He did not look down at his hands as he rippled the cards. He never removed his gaze from Clinton's face, and his smile had still not slipped. Only there was a flush of colour under the dark, sun-touched skin. "You like to live dangerously?" St. John smiled the question. "Oh, no," Clinton shook his head. "I am in no danger. In my experience, slavers are all cowards." Mungo St. John's smile disappeared, extinguished instantly, and his expression was coldly murderous. But his fingers never broke the rhythm of cut and ripple, and the cards flowed under his fingers as Clinton went on evenly. "I was led to believe that so-called Louisiana gentlemen had some exalted code of honour." He shrugged. "I suggest, sir, that you are living contradiction of that notion." Every listener was stunned. Not one of them could doubt what they were hearing. The accusation of slave dealing. To an Englishman, there could be no worse insult. The last English duels had been fought in 1840, when Lord Cardigan shot Captain Tuckett, and in 1843 when Munro shot his brother-in-law, Colonel Fawcett. In consequence of these encounters, the Queen had made her desire for reform known, and the Articles of War were amended in the following year, making duelling an offence. Of course, gentlemen still went abroad, mostly to France, to settle affairs of honour with pistol or sword. But this was Cape Colony, one of the jewels of the Empire, and the naval captain was one of Her Majesty's commissioned officers. The evening had proved diverting, beyond any expectations, and now there was the promise of blood and violent death charging the gaming room. "Gentlemen," an urgent, persuasive voice interrupted them. The Admiral's flag captain had come through from the whist room at the Admiral's orders. "There has been some misunderstanding." But neither of the two men as much as glanced in his direction. "I don't think there has been any misunderstanding at all," Mungo St. John said coldly, his gaze still locked with Clinton's. "Captain Codrington's insults cannot possibly be misinterpreted." "Mr. St. John, may I remind you that you are on British soil, subject to Her Majesty's laws?" The flag captain was becoming desperate. "Oh, Mr. St. John sets little store by laws. He sails his slave ship, fully equipped, into a British harbour." Clinton stared at the American with cold blue eyes. He would have gone on, but St. John interrupted him harshly, speaking to the flag captain but addressing the words to Clinton Codrington. "I would not dream of abusing Her Majesty's hospitality. In any event, I will sail with the tide before noon this day, and in 4 days I shall be far beyond Her Majesty's territory, in latitude 31 degrees, 38 minutes south. There is a wide river mouth there between tall bluffs of stone, a good landing and a wide beach. It is unmistakable." St. John stood up. He had recovered his urbane air, and now he adjusted the ruffles of his shirt front and gave the lovely widow his arm. He paused for a moment to look down at Clinton. "Who knows but that you and I may meet again, when we must certainly discuss the question of honour once more. Until then, I give you good morrow, sir."